This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Several weeks ago, Rachel Corey, an American college student from Olympia, Washington, left for Rafah, a settlement in the Gaza Strip. Rachel was there as part of the international solidarity movement in support of the Palestinian people who have lost homes during the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands in violation of UN resolutions. On March 16th, Rachel was crushed to death by an Israeli soldier driving a bulldozer while she tried to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian doctor. Earlier this week, Peace Watch spoke with Rachel's mom, Cindy Corey, about her memories of her daughter and the meaning of Rachel's actions.
We learned on March 16th that our daughter, Rachel, had been run over by a bulldozer operated by members of the Israeli army, and she subsequently died from her injuries. And she was a member of the International Solidarity Movement. And actually, since that time, there have been two other young people who are with the International Solidarity Movement who have also been seriously injured, one with a shot to the face and one with a shot to the back of his head, as I understand it. That's Brian Avery, who's from the U.S., and Tom Herndahl, who is from the U.K.
And Tom, according to my most recent knowledge or according to recent reports, is in a coma, is he not, or...?
That's what I understand. I haven't had direct contact about that for a couple of days, but that was the latest news that I had.
Mm-hmm. You characterized your daughter's death as having been run over. Others have suggested that perhaps it was an accident. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my husband talked to eyewitnesses that were there immediately after it happened, and he talked to them separately. And it just seems clear from the people that were there that she was run over by this bulldozer, and that then the bulldozer driver left the blade down and backed up again.
Hmm. And so then there are these additional incidents with Tom Herndahl and Brian Avery. Have you spoken to the Israeli government at all about this incident and the death of your daughter?
No, we were contacted by, I think it's the consul, Israeli consul from the San Francisco Israeli consulate, and had very brief conversation my son did with him shortly after this occurred. And I have since communicated with him. I just felt the need to make a call on the day that I heard about Tom Herndahl. Because while I have great empathy for the Israeli people and what they have suffered too, I'm just so upset. I was so upset the day Tom was injured because it seemed like it was happening to us all over again. And it just seems like outrageous behavior. Otherwise, we've had no word from the Israeli government.
And what about the U.S. government?
We are in regular contact with the U.S. State Department, and I know they've called in the Israeli ambassador. I do know that President Bush has spoken with Ariel Sharon. While I do not know the content of that conversation, I do know that our government is waiting, I believe, for a more thorough investigation to be coming from the Israeli government. I know there are some out there that are talking about the Israeli investigation that's out there. Actually, that's a 25-page report. My son has seen it. I have not. But in that report, they hadn't even talked to any eyewitnesses that were at the scene, as I understand it. So we're not considering that an investigation. That's a report that's come from the military in Israel. So we're awaiting further investigation from the Israeli government. But we really have been imploring our government to get involved in this investigation, and now the British government as well. And we would like people, if they want to support us and help us, to urge our government to do that by contacting the White House, the State Department, and people in Congress. There is a resolution that is in the House of Representatives. It's HCR 111. It's now in a House subcommittee, and that's the House Committee on the Middle East and Central Asia. And we would like people to contact the committee chair. Her name is Ileana Ross-Lettinen, and she's from Florida. And just to urge that this resolution be brought out of committee. People can also contact Henry Hyde, who is the chair of the House International Relations Committee, which is where the resolution would go if it was brought out of the subcommittee.
Mm-hmm. And exactly what does the resolution call for?
It calls for the United States and Israel to work together to have a fair and extensive investigation. Basically, it calls for the United States to become involved in an independent investigation of this incident, and also to try to work together to make sure no other incidents of this kind happen again. I feel sad about that piece because already we've had two further incidents.
Mm. Are you
in addition, I should say, there are people who I know who say, well, they shouldn't be there, they shouldn't have been there. But I think what the American people need to realize that is if these young people weren't there taking these bullets and this kind of aggression toward nonviolent peace activists, trying to prevent illegal demolitions of homes and wells and fields and gardens, that then Palestinian people would be taking this. And they already are. It's going on week after week after week. And I feel like it gets very minimal notice about the ongoing occupation and the violence that's a part of that.
Did Rachel's politics evolve out of politics that perhaps you and your husband share around this particular issue?
You know, really, you know, Rachel educated us, and I'm sometimes almost embarrassed to admit that through, you know, how many years, 50 years of learning about this situation, I think we all become numb to it. We hear a minimal statement, something flashes across our TV screen, we hear about a suicide bombing, and that does get more attention, I think, and those are deplorable, and they should get attention, but I think we're not getting the other side. I feel like Rachel has really educated us, and we're working all the time to learn all that we can. She had, after 9/11, she decided to become a peace activist, and that she was in college at the time. She also worked here in this community. She was very active. She worked with behavioral health resources, and that's working with people that have mental illness, and she was very committed to social justice in all kinds of arenas and had become really active with that. But after 9/11, she decided to focus on peace activism, and she joined, there are numbers of groups here in our community in Olympia, Washington that are involved with those issues, and one in particular was for peace in the Middle East. She spent a lot of time learning and reading. She sent me books to read. I know, I remember one called, I think it's Mothers and Daughters, written by an Israeli psychiatrist and a Palestinian friend of his, and it's telling the stories of three Palestinian women and then their three daughters. So she was trying to educate us as she was learning too.
Mm. She also, I'm told, did a lot of writing on her own, and you have some of those that you want to share with us at this time?
Well, I'm trying to find something. There's so much here, and but let me just share this because it's something that she wrote when she was trying to describe the situation to us. She said, "Today, as I walked on top of the rubble where homes once stood, Egyptian soldiers called to me from the other side of the border, 'Go, go,' because a tank was coming, followed by waving and, 'What's your name?' There is something disturbing about this friendly curiosity. It reminded me of how much, to some degree, we are all kids curious about other kids. Egyptian kids shouting at strange women wandering into the path of tanks. Palestinian kids shot from the tanks when they peek out from behind walls to see what's going on. International kids standing in front of tanks with banners. Israeli kids in the tanks anonymously, occasionally shouting and also occasionally waving. Many forced to be here, many just aggressive, shooting into the houses as we wander away." I feel like Rachel is just nudging me on every day, mm-hmm. and I get tired, but I know that she would want us to use this occasion to bring attention to the problem that she was trying to do something about.
The mother picking up the cause where the daughter left off?
I don't know if I can do it quite like she did, but I at least want people to learn about the situation and to learn about Rachel and why she was there.
Cindy Corey speaking about the death of her daughter, American peace activist Rachel Corey, killed in the Gaza Strip by an Israeli soldier operating a bulldozer. After our interview, we learned that the Israeli government had found the soldier innocent of any wrongdoing and that Rachel was guilty of illegal and dangerous behavior.
My dreams the other night, I met a girl who led the fight to save innocents and their homes. Standing there in front of me, live as life could be, a willowy blonde named Rachel Corey. Are there any shining stars falling from the skies at night? Though the mesh may seem so coarse, heaven's nets cast wide. They struck you, Rachel, I had to say. Your stand that day, though the scribes here spoke hardly a word. You traveled so far overseas to help those in a dire country rather than dwell in luxury. Are there any shining stars falling from the sky? Nets cast wide. Takes more than dozers, it would seem, to silence a girl and her dreams. Miss Rachel Corey softly explained. When you see folks gather round to protect civilians and their towns, that is where you forever will find me. Are there any shining stars falling from the skies at night? Nothing slips through mesh so coarse when heaven's nets cast wide.
Ballad of Rachel Corey by the Zachary Jones Band. Well, the war has everyone reexamining their positions on complex issues of war and peace. Peace Watch commentator Ruth Rosen shares her experience of a recent discussion she had with the parents of two soldiers currently fighting in Iraq.
Every soldier, someone's child. Memphis. Like strangers on a train, we suddenly turn to intimate conversation. We are sitting on a sofa in a hotel lobby, each waiting for someone else. We share the remnants of a newspaper and stare at the front page photographs of a battlefield in Iraq. I see my own anguish mirrored in his face. You're probably against the war, he says, aware that a forum on the war in Iraq has just ended. I nod. We introduce ourselves, and by chance, we know each other by reputation. Both of us were activists in movements for social change in the 1960s. He worked in the civil rights movement in the South, and his wife, whose name I recognize, was a major organizer in the civil rights and anti-war movements. "But we shifted," he says. "Both of us support this war." I want to be respectful of his beliefs, and before I can think of any response, he begins to speak of his two sons. Both are in the military. One is in the reserves, and the other is an officer in the Marines, fighting in Iraq right now. They're both opposed to this war. My mind begins to swirl. Former anti-war activists now support a war that their two sons, both in the Marines, oppose. I have many questions, but they seem intrusive, so I remain silent. "I can't tell you what a nightmare this is," he continues. "At night I wake up every 2 hours worrying about my son. Is he still alive? Will he survive?" His eyes look down. His face droops with exhaustion. "If I had a son in the war, I would be out of my mind," I say, feeling enormous empathy. Then I resume my silence, sensing that the best way to offer comfort is just to listen. "They say we should support the troops," he says, "but what does that really mean? It's such an empty cliche, a kind of fake test of patriotism. I know you want the troops to come home safely. I know you're not unpatriotic. The best way to support the troops is to end the war quickly and to treat their ailments seriously." I nod in agreement. Oddly enough, just a few hours earlier, I heard Chris Appy, author of the forthcoming book, Patriots, The Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides, speak about what it means to support the troops. "Soldiers," he said, "are demoralized not by criticism on the home front, but by the gap between official rhetoric and what they experience firsthand on the battlefield. It's the government," he argued, "that has not supported our troops enough. Washington did not recognize post-traumatic stress disorder for a decade after Vietnam. The government has just barely recognized the Gulf War syndrome. Even now," Appy noted, "Washington wants to cut veterans' benefits." "Both my sons finished college, got honors, and expect to get a PhD," the father tells me, with obvious pride. "You know, it's not true that all soldiers choose the military because they're poor or can't find another job." I allow myself one question. "Why did they join the Marines?" His answer surprises me. "They disliked the consumerism and materialism of American life. They wanted to live a more Spartan existence, to feel a greater purpose in life." My friend arrives and I must leave. Strangers no more, we turn to each other, shake hands warmly, and say goodbye. I tell him his son will remain in my thoughts, and he does. A few days later, I call the stranger's wife, who has heard about our conversation. She greets me warmly, if warily, since we hold different views on the war. I ask about her husband's son. She has no news. "When I watch the television," she tells me, "I am so envious when other soldiers are interviewed. I hope their parents are watching. Now I understand what I didn't fully grasp decades ago. Every soldier is someone's child." And now, as a result of this chance encounter, I know it too, more than ever before.
Peace Watch commentator Ruth Rosen, her article entitled "Every Soldier, Someone's Child," appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle earlier this week. Finally tonight, MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky offers these thoughts on the Bush administration's propaganda campaign leading up to the war on Iraq.
"We're all aware that right at this moment, bodies are being torn to shreds by infernal weapons. Unknown numbers of people who have already been driven to the edge of survival by a decade of murderous sanctions may be facing starvation and slow death. Under these circumstances, it's not very easy to step back and try to ask why all this is happening, where it's likely to go, what we can do to shape the future. And what we can do to shape the future, the answer is straightforward, quite a lot. In fact, there's no one anywhere who can do as much as we can. We're uniquely privileged. Privilege and advantages confer responsibility. even before the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. political leadership had inspired extraordinary level of fear throughout the world. Since the invasion, the war that the world is seeing, that war has aroused a wave of revulsion that's actually becoming a serious concern even to policymakers here, and it's reaching the mainstream press. The director of the Center for Strategic Studies in Jordan says that without doubt, Saddam now occupies the high moral ground across the Arab world. And he finds that very disturbing, thinks it's going to cause huge problems for countries like Jordan and Egypt, especially if there's any step towards democratization. Because if the voice of the people is heard, he knows what voice it's going to be. It's going to be the voice of radical Islamists who are calling for a war against America, and also secular nationalists who despise Saddam Hussein but now admire him because he's standing up to the savage Americans and no one else is. And in death, he's likely to become an even greater hero. Well, one recent story in the big long story in the Washington Post about all this opens by saying something ominous is brewing that does not portend well for the United States. And that's an understatement. It does not. Now, that's quite an achievement by George W. Bush and his associate. These discussions are referring to the Arab and the Muslim world. Actually, that's the world that they claim to be liberating. In fact, it extends far beyond, seems to be worldwide. If somebody was watching all of this from outer space, they might be led to believe that George Bush was embedded in the White House as an agent of Osama bin Laden. He's certainly acting that way. September was the opening of the political campaign for the midterm elections. And that was combined with an enormous propaganda campaign, which began to present Iraq, Saddam Hussein, as an imminent threat to the survival of the United States, with insinuations that Iraq was responsible for the September 11th attacks. Actually, if you look at the New York Times, Karl Rove, who's George Bush's minder, as they call him in Iraq, he describes it. He says the goal is that in order to pursue the domestic agenda, it's necessary to frighten the population, make the population feel that they have to shelter under behind the powerful leader who's going to save them from destruction. You can do that. You can pursue your domestic agenda. Otherwise, not. He's talking about what we have to do in the what they're going to have to do in the future. But he also says, yeah, that's what they did in the past, and that's correct. In September, Condoleezza Rice showed up with her prediction that the next thing we're going to hear about Saddam Hussein is a mushroom cloud. They're planning to destroy us. And then there came a series of outlandish lies repeated passionately by Bush and others, distributed quite uncritically by the media, and it had an immediate effect. You take a look at polls by September, after this campaign began, roughly 60% of the population believed it. Believes that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat. They got to keep repeating it to keep that level up. About half the population believe that Iraq was responsible for the September 11th attack, that Iraqis were on the planes. Those beliefs turn out to be highly correlated with support for the war, and it's understandable. If you think that Saddam Hussein's an imminent threat, already destroyed the World Trade Center, planning something new, maybe a nuclear bomb, yeah, then it's understandable that you'd want to do something to get rid of them. That's a remarkable achievement of government media propaganda. You have to bear in mind that this is unique to the United States. Nowhere else where anyone believes anything like this, nor is it believed here by anybody who knows anything, like CIA or foreign policy analysts. But it has been imposed on the population. And that's impressive. It's not the first time, but it's impressive. It was aimed at the election, and for the election, it just barely worked. I mean, they barely managed to maintain control. And something similar is going to be needed for the next election. That's what Rove says. He says, for the next election, we've got to create an image of George Bush as a powerful leader, a savior, who by then will be marching off to slay some new dragons. So it's going to be something to do next year. Well, for the guys in power, the current administration, all of this is kind of reflexive. It's just second nature. Remember that these is almost the same people who ran the country in the Reagan-Bush 1 administrations. It's sort of astonishing when you look at, put yourself in the position of the Martian observer again, and recognize that it's just elementary sanity if you want to figure out what these guys are up to ask what they did during their first tenure in power.
Renowned author and analyst Noam Chomsky speaking recently in Boulder, Colorado, thanks to Pacifica affiliate KGNU for that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adil Hamid of KPFA and Keith Shaljian. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.